The azaleas are in bloom, and that means the legislative session in Tallahassee is just around the corner. What's likely to happen, and how will it affect you? This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sussingham. This week on Florida Matters, we're exploring some interesting bills in the upcoming legislative session and talking about the politics behind it all, some contentious politics this year. We'll hear from a longtime political observer about what he thinks are some of the major issues this year. But first, the Florida Senate has a plan that would bring sweeping changes to the state's higher education system. Florida Matters' Kathy Carter has more on the Excellence in Higher Education Act.
A couple of issues are basically settled before the legislature starts. One would bankroll a program to recruit top-level faculty to Florida's universities. Another expands the state's Bright Future Scholarship and other scholarships. Not much controversy there. But lawmakers have heard an earful about a couple of proposals. Both would affect the way students pay for college. Roxanne Guevara is working towards her associate's degree at Miami-Dade College. She maintains a 3.8 grade point average, but as she recently testified at a Senate committee hearing, she has to work part-time, so she won't be able to finish her degree in 2 years.
My family sometimes has to pay over $700 a semester. I constantly am applying for scholarships, but sometimes that's not enough.
New standards in the bill would have created an evaluation based on students earning a degree in 2 years for an associate's and 4 for a bachelor's. Under the current system, schools are measured on a 3-year and 6-year standard. Dr. Lenore Radicchio is the provost for Miami-Dade College. She says she agrees with the Senate's proposal to improve the state's graduation rate, but asks lawmakers to temper their expectations.
66% of our students come from low-income families, and 45% of those live below the poverty level. These students have no choice but to work to support their families.
Those concerns were echoed by other Florida State College presidents, and an amendment to the bill has since been adopted. The measurement still places a premium on the 4-year graduation rate for Florida's 12 universities, but the metric won't be weighed as heavily for Florida's 28 state colleges. But some still worry that new graduation expectations will have a negative impact. Antoine Kirkendall is a student at Hillsborough Community College in Tampa with plans to transfer to the University of South Florida. He thinks the change could affect things like how professors grade their students.
I'm going to have to sit up here and meet a quota. So even though you are a D student, I'm going to give you that C grade because I have to push you forward. So now it's going to be people that have degrees that did not earn it.
Several lawmakers also voiced concern over costs. The bill contains several enhancements for financial aid, like Bright Futures, but some say that's not enough. Republican Senator Tom Lee is from Brandon. His district includes the University of South Florida.
And as we evolve this piece of legislation, let's just make sure that we don't turn our post-secondary education system into elitist institutions that are only available to those who can fit into our vision of what college life ought to look like.
Enley isn't fully sold on a proposal that would have Florida's universities charge students a flat fee per semester. He says the block tuition policy would still likely mean that a full-time student would have to go to school year-round, and that means missing out on internships and summer employment. Senate President Joe Negron has said he wants Florida's public universities to be on the same par as destination schools, like the University of Virginia and the University of North Carolina. They attract local students and a larger number of out-of-state students. They have 4-year graduation rates at 87 and 81% respectively. In Florida, the 4-year graduation rate ranges from 67% for the University of Florida to 13.5% at Florida A&M University. That's just not good enough, says the bill's author, Republican Bill Galvano of Bradenton.
The bottom line is we recognize that we're the third largest state in the union. We're number one destination in the world. We should be at the very top of our game when it comes to our college and university system.
The education proposal has an almost identical companion in Florida's House of Representatives, where discussion is still in its earlier stages. Senator Negron, meanwhile, says he wants to see a vote in the Senate during the first week of the session, which begins March 7th. For Florida Matters, I'm Kathy Carter.
Joining me in the studio now is William March, a political columnist with the Tampa Bay Times. He goes by the nickname Wendy. Wendy, welcome to Florida Matters.
Thanks, Robin. Nice to be here.
So this Senate Bill 2, Excellence in Higher Education, that's ready to go to the Senate floor when the session starts. You know, what kind of odds are you putting on this bill? What's the problems with it?
Well, there are going to be some changes. And you heard what Tom Lee had to say. Lee's very influential in the budget process in the Florida Senate. The problem is that a smaller and smaller proportion of all our college students look like the traditional model where the young high school graduate goes off to college and doesn't do anything else for 4 years.
Right.
A lot of them have to do a lot of other things. Some of them are supporting families. And that is Lee's concern when he used the term elitist, that traditional student usually is better off financially than the one who has to work. And that's why Lee says he's worried about this bill turning our university system into an elitist bastion.
So you think it's going to change?
I think the bill will be modified. It's already been amended somewhat in connection with the graduation rates and the penalties. My understanding is that bill has been changed so that it doesn't apply to those who start off as non-traditional students, but that still leaves those who start as traditional students, but then for whatever reason have to go part-time because they encounter financial problems.
Okay.
Another big education issue that's coming up this year, Robin, is teacher pay.
Right.
Governor Rick Scott proposed spending some $50 million to increase teacher pay, basically along the lines of bonuses of various kinds for teachers that meet the criteria. But the House K through 12 education chairman, Republican David Simmons, wants to go a lot farther than that, maybe spend four or even five times that much to boost public school teachers' pay.
And there's a lot of turnover, as you know, with teachers right now in Florida. But I'm not hearing, when I talk to teachers, I don't hear so much that it's the pay as the stress of the job, the testing. Do they think that the pay is going to help with retention?
Well, the pay certainly would help with retention. Half of all newly hired Florida school teachers do not make it to their 10th year in the job before quitting.
Moving on to another big topic, health care. Florida's under a law right now that says communities have to get permission from regulators before they can open a new hospital or a nursing home. State legislators will consider getting rid of that law and say a repeal would drive down health care prices and improve quality. Opponents say it will have the opposite effect. So who's right? Florida Matters' Julio Ochoa reports that some states have done away with similar laws and the results are mixed.
Economists say it's a simple case of supply and demand. The more hospitals you have, the more competition there is. Consumers win because competition tends to drive down prices and improve quality. But researchers say healthcare is not like buying another commodity, like a car or a cheeseburger. Michael Roscoe is a business professor at Widener University in Pennsylvania. He says hospitals don't typically advertise their prices, so consumers aren't able to search for the cheapest facilities.
You know, if you look at how hospitals compete, you know, how many times do you see a billboard saying special this week on appendectomies?
Instead, hospitals compete on reputation. They boast about having the best treatments and doctors on staff. Roscoe's research found that healthcare facilities in states with certificate of need regulations were more cost efficient. The regulations, he found, helped hospitals avoid unnecessary duplication of healthcare facilities. They also help hospitals maintain higher occupancy rates.
We don't want a healthcare facility that's only operating at 20% because you've got some really expensive fixed costs. And what you want to do is spread that output over as many patients as possible.
Florida has regulated the establishment of new hospitals, nursing homes, and hospices since the 1970s. At the time, hospitals were in a battle to outspend each other on technology. And Medicare payments were structured in a way that allowed hospitals to recoup the costs. But in 1984, after the government reformed Medicare payments and researchers suggested the regulations weren't working, the federal mandate was dropped. Since then, 13 states, including Texas and California, have repealed certificate of need regulations. Some other states have cut them back. The split has given researchers a lot to study, but the results are still mixed.
You can't really give certificate of need a simple thumbs up or thumbs down.
That's Mary Vaughn Sarazen, a professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of Iowa. Sarazen has published multiple studies examining certificate of need regulations. In 2002, she found that mortality rates for heart bypass surgery were higher in states such as Texas, California, and Colorado that did not have certificate of need regulations. Her research supported a theory that consolidating specialized procedures at a few facilities ensures those healthcare teams do more procedures. That way, they gain more expertise and experience.
You can imagine if you're a patient and you're faced with undergoing cardiac bypass, would you rather have it done in a hospital that performs one bypass a week or in a hospital that performs 20 a week?
A second study by Sarazen in 2009, however, found that certain procedures increase in states that repealed certificate of need regulations, and the risks associated with those procedures decreased. Or, as an economist would say, increased access resulted in improvements in quality and quantity. Matthew Mitchell is a senior research fellow at George Mason University. He says his review of the research found no evidence that certificate of need laws improved quality or costs.
When firms are not facing competition, they can afford to ignore patient or consumer desires and costs.
Several states have peeled back certificate of need regulations for some types of procedures and facilities while leaving them in place for others. So far, the bill sponsors in Florida haven't considered a partial repeal, but the debate could be a robust one. For Florida Matters, I'm Julio Ochoa.
So, Wendy, State Senator Rob Bradley filed this bill. He says, quote, "For years, this cumbersome process has been used to block the expansion of facilities and restrict competition." Governor Rick Scott also wants to eliminate the Certificate of Need program. So what do you think the chances are?
Well, I think the chances are very good that they will either eliminate it or substantially change it. As you noted, Governor Scott is strongly on one side of this argument. His career, his very large fortune, came in the business of operating private for-profit hospitals, and he has in the past been a strong opponent of nonprofit hospitals, public hospitals, so to speak. I think there's, as Julio reported in the piece, there is evidence that eliminating certificates of need does expand the choices available to consumers. One of the problems some legislators are worried about is that it would also cause hospital chains or healthcare organizations to concentrate in wealthy areas in cities and ignore urban areas, leaving rural people with fewer choices.
Why would that happen? So if there was an area, that's happening already. Rural areas don't have access to a lot of hospitals.
Well, because if you're a hospital executive, say in a for-profit chain, and your goal is to make money, and you have a choice between building a hospital in a rural area with a very thin population and building it in a dense urban area where you might be competing, you'll choose the dense urban area where you might be competing, but where you'll have a much larger population base. Now, if the certificate of need process were in place, it might say that you couldn't build there. You had to go elsewhere to a place that was underserved. So some legislators are worried that it could cause that phenomenon.
So worsen the dearth of hospitals in rural areas is
what
they're
right.
concerned about. So, Wendy, one thing we saw with this incredible participation in the women's marches is that abortion is still a very hot topic. So what's happening with that on the state level?
Well, it's a very hot topic there, too, also, Robin. For the last several legislative sessions, each year, the pro-life faction, the anti-abortion faction in the Florida legislature has come up with new pieces of legislation every year to try to put restrictions on abortion, and this year's no exception. The major bills that are being brought forward this year would be a ban on abortions after 20 weeks and a piece of legislation giving a patient 10 years after the procedure occurs, if she decides that she regrets it or that it wasn't handled properly, for 10 years afterwards, she could sue the provider.
I think they'll hear from the medical association on that one, probably.
Absolutely. They may hear from the courts, on the other hand, in terms of the 20-week ban. Planned Parenthood is already suing to overturn similar bans in three other states. The argument that they make is that it violates, obviously, the Roe versus Wade Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion, and also subsequent decisions which have said a state can place reasonable restrictions on access to abortion, but it cannot place restrictions that are so burdensome that they, in effect, amount to a ban.
This is Florida Matters, and we're previewing the state's legislative session. My guest is Wendy March, correspondent with the Tampa Bay Times. I'm Robin Sessingham. We'll be right back. This is Florida Matters, and we're talking about some important issues surrounding this year's legislative session. There's little or no opposition to one bill facing Florida lawmakers. It would set standards to quickly notify the public about pollution. As Florida Matters' Stephanie Colombini reports, it's an issue familiar to the Tampa Bay area.
It's pouring rain in downtown Tampa. Standing just outside Port Tampa Bay, you can see towering cargo ships, rumbling trucks and equipment. Justin Bloom is executive director of Suncoast Waterkeeper, an environmental advocacy group. He says most commercial industries, like those operating at the port, are highly regulated to ensure environmental safety precautions are in place.
But extraordinary events happen, and sometimes these safety measures are ignored. You know, look at what happened with Mosaic, for example.
A reference to last August, when a massive sinkhole opened under a gypsum stack at a Mosaic phosphate fertilizer plant in Polk County. 215 million gallons of contaminated water dumped into the Floridian aquifer, and it was weeks before the public knew about it. Bloom says while that was and is a serious concern, a more significant threat is constant stormwater runoff. The day-to-day pollutants on our lawns, sidewalks, driveways, not to mention toilets, on a rainy day like this, often end up in our water, especially in the summer.
This type of rain would seriously stress many of the municipal sewage systems in this region, to the point where they might not be able to process all of the stormwater which finds its way in.
That's exactly what happened last summer when Hurricane Hermine led several cities and counties to dump hundreds of millions of gallons of sewage. The city of St. Petersburg was the worst offender and kept mum for a few days before announcing the spills. Signs at places like Lassing Park Beach near Albert Whitted Airport warned residents to stay out of the water until bacteria levels came down. Those signs are long gone, but for park visitor Diana Kenny, the stigma remains.
I come down here from North Carolina to do a lot of sailing, to do kayaking, and now I feel like I can't get in the water. And I was born here, and it just hurts my soul to know that I can look at it, but I can't get in.
St. Pete resident Elaine Grace says she lets her dog go in the bay from time to time now that it's safe. But she's still concerned about future spills.
It really worries me that myself, my pets, our people that are down here with their children all the time on the weekends are going to be exposed to what could be serious illnesses. And so I think we do need to be aware of something like that occurring immediately.
In light of the sewage dumps and Mosaic sinkhole, Florida Governor Rick Scott ordered companies to notify the public of any potentially dangerous release, but a judge overturned the rule. That's where Senator Bill Galvano of Bradenton comes in. His bill would require companies to notify the Department of Environmental Protection within 24 hours of discovering a reportable release. What's a reportable release? That would be up to DEP to decide. It would also be on DEP to notify the public within a day of getting a report. John Palanchar, interim director of St. Petersburg's Water Resources Department, says the bill's a significant improvement.
What we did see directly after the emergency rule was people reporting everything. It was almost frivolous, some of the things that were getting reported.
Palanchar says the bill will prevent a boy who cried wolf situation, where residents become desensitized to pollution notices. He says the bill is also better for smaller players, like farmers and mom-and-pop businesses, who might not be able to blast out a press release while trying to fix a problem.
To be able to rely on the deeper resources of the state, I think it will actually provide a better reporting mechanism.
As for the city of St. Pete, Palinchar says they've learned their lesson since last year's spills. Regardless of any legislation, they'll be keeping city residents informed. Justin Bloom with Suncoast Waterkeeper applauds the bill, but he questions whether politics and lack of funds could get in the way of DEP enforcing the requirements.
We'll see how, if it's passed, how the department will craft rules, and I hope that there's a lot of opportunity for the public to weigh in on that.
Until then, it's up to Floridians to keep their eyes, ears, and nostrils open for any signs of pollution. For Florida Matters, I'm Stephanie Colombini.
I'm Robin Sessingham, and this is Florida Matters. We're talking with political columnist Wendy March with the Tampa Bay Times. Wendy, on another environmental front, the Everglades cleanup saga continues. There's one proposal to buy 60,000 acres south of Lake Okeechobee as a water storage reservoir. What's happening with that proposal?
Well, the purpose of the reservoir would be to prevent the algae blooms we've seen on both coasts that occur when dirty, nutrient-laden water from Lake Okeechobee is discharged through canals that go both east and west to the coasts. Senator Joe Negron, who is in a very powerful position as Senate president, wants to create this reservoir, wants to spend the money to buy it, but he doesn't have support from either the governor or the state house and Speaker Richard Corcoran on that proposal.
Why not? So
at least one reason is that Rick Scott, in his budget proposal, proposed spending far less money on environmental land preservation than Negron's plan would require. Another reason, frankly, is this is always going to be a difficult subject in Florida because of the opposition to Big Sugar, the sugar industry. At least a couple of key legislators, Matt Caldwell and Denise Grimsley, are looking at running for agriculture secretary, and they want the support of the sugar industry if they do. The current agriculture secretary, Adam Putnam, is looking at running for governor, and he wants the sugar industry support. So that's at least part of the problem.
And what you're saying is a lot of that land that they would need to buy south of Lake Okeechobee is growing sugar cane.
Correct.
So they would need to, they would pay them, but it would be sort of an eminent domain sort of a situation.
It could be.
And the money, as I understand it, is there. It would take $1.2 billion, I think, to buy this 60,000 acres. But the money's there because there's money set aside from Amendment 1.
Well, that opens up another controversy, Robin, because there was money designated by Amendment 1 that would be adequate to pay for this reservoir plan.
And this was money that was supposed to be set aside. The voters voted to set aside this money to purchase environmentally sensitive land.
But since that amendment passed, environmentalists say the legislature has simply just ignored it. They haven't spent the money for that purpose and aren't willing to now.
Another tricky issue coming up is going to be the state budget. You've said before that it could be a potential crisis this year. Why is that?
Well, to begin with, Governor Scott wants to put in place some pretty large tax cuts. He's planning on running for the Senate in 2018, and he wants the tax cuts, at least in part, to burnish his political reputation. But at the same time, there are a lot of other priorities that the legislators themselves want. Among them is the environmental project that we just talked about that Senator Negron favors, the reservoir. Everybody wants to increase spending on public education, but the way that Governor Scott proposes doing it is not by appropriating more state money, but by forcing the school districts to collect more property tax money back in their home counties. Without that, the question is, where would the money come from for all of these priorities? Making it even more difficult is that Richard Corcoran,
the House Speaker,
who also would like to run for governor in a couple of years, has proposed new budget procedures in the legislature that would make it much more difficult for legislators to successfully seek what are called member projects, sometimes called turkeys, appropriations for benefits back in their district. And he's engaging in an argument with the Senate over that subject. So the budget is looking like it's even more problematic this year than it has been in the last couple of years.
And the Visit Florida Enterprise Florida fight's going to play into this.
What's happening there is that one of Corcoran's reform measures that he's pushing very hard is to cut funding for financial incentives, tax breaks that are used to lure businesses. He also wants to cut funding for tourism marketing, both at the state level and at the national level. That idea is sharply opposed by Governor Rick Scott.
To put it mildly,
it's led to a huge public relations battle with these two, Corcoran and Rick Scott, who are in the same party, of course, both Republicans, actually making videos trashing each other, and Rick Scott saying that these are anti-job politicians. This is the kind of thing that Republicans don't normally say about other Republicans. My belief is that that issue will be settled, that a compromise will be reached, but meanwhile, it's making it more difficult for them to agree on other things.
I can't let you go without asking you about gun legislation and what's going on with that in the legislature this year.
Well, it's going to be another big year, and this is the year that you could see some major changes enacted that have been stalled in the past, partly because of more conservative members becoming more dominant in the Florida Senate, which has prevented some of these bills from passing. Senator Greg Stube of Sarasota is a major player. He has sponsored some 9 bills that would expand gun rights. This would include open carry of guns, campus carry.
He has said that he pretty much wants guns to be able to be anywhere, anytime.
Pretty much close to that. I mean, airport terminals, state and local government meetings. There's also a bill that if, for example, a movie theater or another public accommodation space denies you the ability to carry your gun there and you get injured, you can sue them for refusing you permission to carry your gun to defend yourself with. And then finally, the next big thing on the gun agenda this year is a change in the Stand Your Ground law that would make it easier for people accused of killing someone to claim self-defense under the Stand Your Ground Act. The interesting thing is that several of these different pieces of legislation in the past couple of sessions have been stopped in the Senate Judiciary Committee by its chairman, who's a comparative moderate on gun issues, named Miguel Diaz de la Portilla. Well, he lost his seat in 2016, and he's been replaced by Senator Stube, who was a strong advocate of expanding gun rights.
And Stube's reasoning for having expanded access to carrying your gun is?
Well, Stube believes that if lots of people have guns, then if something bad happens, they can stop it. A good guy with a gun is the solution to a problem caused by a bad guy with a gun, is essentially his point of view.
That's it for today's show. Thank you so much to William Wendy March, a political columnist with the Tampa Bay Times. Thanks for joining us, Wendy.
Glad to be here, Rob.
You can find more on the upcoming legislative session on our website, WUSFnews.org, or leave a comment on our Facebook page. And tune in for our live coverage of Governor Scott's State of the State Address, which starts at 11 a.m. on March 7th. Our show is produced by Stephanie Colombini. Our engineer is Craig George. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Robin Sussingham. Thanks for listening.